Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Several recent studies examined how machine automation and artificial intelligence, or AI, will change the future of work. Some estimates predict these technologies could displace up to 30% of workers worldwide by 2030. One study was published by PricewaterhouseCoopers, an international company providing financial and tax services. It predicted about 38% of American jobs could be at high risk for automation by the early 2030s. In Germany, up to 35% of jobs could be at risk. The company said about 30% could be affected in Britain and 21% in Japan. The risk of being displaced will greatly increase for workers with less education, PricewaterhouseCoopers said. It estimated that in Britain, up to 46% of workers without a college degree could be at risk due to automation. This would drop to about 12% for workers with undergraduate degrees or higher. New smart machines have the potential to replace our minds and to move around freely in the world, the study said. It added that the greatest job displacement is expected to come in the areas of transportation, storage, manufacturing, and retail. The Rand Corporation recently issued its own report on the future effects of automation and AI on jobs and the workplace. Oshande Oshaba was a co-author of the report. He noted that fears over machines taking jobs from humans goes back centuries. In 16th century England, Queen Elizabeth famously refused an inventor's request for a patent for a device to make material for clothing. The Queen explained that the device would lead to major job losses, forcing affected workers to become beggars. Oshaba agrees there will be major job disruptions due to AI and automation, especially for lower-skilled workers. But he told VOA he believes the future problems have been overestimated without historical evidence to back up the predictions.
It's not so much that the jobs are getting displaced, it's more like tasks are getting displaced and jobs are reconfiguring over time to account for that automation.
He added that it will be very difficult for companies to completely automate most jobs because they require a worker to perform many different duties and to react to unexpected situations. The RAND report identifies three job types that will be very difficult to replace with a machine. These include jobs depending on human motor skills, positions requiring creative thinking and actions, and jobs dealing with intense social issues interaction. There are recent examples of companies like Google and Facebook using AI to limit certain kinds of content. Oshaba says this can be problematic for machines which do not understand cultural norms in the population.
So that understanding of cultural norms, of social norms, of ethical norms, that's not something that's easy, at least so far. We haven't found that easy to program into artificial intelligence.
The McKinsey Global Institute, a private think tank, has also studied the issue. Its research suggests that up to one-third of work activities across 46 nations could be displaced by 2030. The organization's report predicts automation could force 75 million to 375 million workers into new job areas by 2030. McKinsey identified several jobs that will not be easily replaceable by machines. These include healthcare providers, engineers, scientists, accountants, technology experts, and managers. It also predicted rising demand for educators and creatives, a group of workers including artists, performers, and entertainers. The study said automation will also raise productivity and economic growth. It said this growth, along with other economic influences, could help offset the displacement of millions of workers. All workers will need to adapt as their occupations evolve alongside increasingly capable machines, the report said. McKinsey says this will require ongoing retraining of workers. In addition, employees will be spending more time on activities difficult to automate. This includes tasks requiring emotional, creative, and cognitive skills, the study said. Rand Corporation's Oshande Oshaba agrees. He says workers will increasingly have to be willing and prepared to regularly change jobs and roles to keep up with technology.
If you're thinking about concrete things an individual might do to prepare themselves, I guess being more adaptable, being more flexible, being able to re-educate yourself to fit into a different job.
He added that there will be a great need in the future for many more AI developers and researchers. For this reason, he suggests young people interested in these areas start their career paths early to prepare for these high-paying, competitive jobs. I'm Brian Lynn.
World's largest paper companies has gone against its promise to end several land disputes in Indonesia. The company, Asia Pulp and Paper, makes many kinds of paper products that people all over the world use, including photocopy paper, cigarette boxes, bottle labels, food wrappers, and noodle cups. It wants to use a wood supplier company that has been at the center of land conflicts. Through that supplier, Asia Pulp and Paper is going forward with plans to to take 66,000 hectares of state land in the group of islands called Bangka Belitung near Sumatra. Such a move would affect some 100,000 people. 40 villages oppose it. It differs from Asia Pulp and Paper's promise less than 5 years ago to gain the free, prior, and informed consent of local communities when developing new plantations. Free, prior, and informed consent, also known as FPIC, is an international law protecting the rights of indigenous people. It requires companies to include local communities in decisions about their land and any other decisions that may affect them. Bangka and another major island in the area have already been harmed and polluted by illegal tin mining. Villagers are also distrustful of industrial plantations after palm oil companies broke promises about their land. Roadside signs say, "We reject industrial forestry plantations," and "No BRS." The letters BRS stand for Bangun Rimba Sejahtera, the supplier company that is a front for Asia Pulp and Paper's expansion in the area. The company says BRS is close to being approved as a wood supplier.
"If this land is taken by BRS, where shall we go?" said Yunus, the religious leader of Tambang Unum village. "This land supports our society and economy," he said. "We are ready to go to war. It's better than dying slowly. It's better for us to die at once." Asia Pulp and Paper is the name for a group of mills and forestry companies. Together, they are part of the international company Sinarmas, which is run by an Indonesian family. A representative from Asia Pulp and Paper told the Associated Press, or AP, in July that BRS and a second possible supplier have no ties with Asia Pulp and Paper or with Sinarmas. However, AP reporters recently looked into the ownership of 27 companies that supply Sinarmas. They found that Sinarmas has a powerful influence over most of the companies. Documents show that BRS was a Sinarmas-owned company for much of the past 10 years. In the documents, BRS's ties to Sinarmas appear to end in 2013. That is when it received its license to the state land on Bangka. In West Bangka, thousands of villagers have been protesting against the company outside local government offices.
"No matter how hard they try to force us, we will not give even one scrap of land to any company," said Sartajoyo, the head of Simpangtiga village. Villagers make a living by growing palm oil, muntok peppercorns, and other crops such as rubber and rice. They also grow medicinal crops and wild honey, as well as a profitable type of mushroom from forests that make up about 15% of the land the state gave to BRS. In May, more than half of the 40 affected villages described their opposition in a letter to the local government. They also sent the letter to Indonesia's Ministry of Forestry and Environment. Some village officials say BRS offered what it called a partnership. The deal would permit villagers to use a small part of the land, but only to grow rubber. Kastani, the leader of Ayer Munduyong village, said the company contacted him in May and offered to set up a meeting with Sin Armas. But he refused. He said no one in his village wants to surrender land. It's our livelihood, Castani said. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. James Madison of Virginia was elected President of the United States in 1808. He was inaugurated in Washington on March 4, 1809. The people of the city were happy with the new president, but the nation was not yet sure what kind of leader he would be. Madison's first 4 years were not easy. He had to deal with a foreign policy problem that the former president, Thomas Jefferson, was not able to solve: increasingly tense relations with Britain. Historian Alan Taylor has written several books on early American history and has won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing. He says Madison took office under difficult circumstances.
Jefferson, in many ways, was a tough act to follow because he'd been extraordinarily popular. But he had made one great policy mistake with Madison's support. Madison had been his Secretary of State. And that mistake was something known as the embargo.
The embargo had arisen from a war between Britain and France. The two nations refused to honor America's neutrality. Each tried to prevent the United States from trading with the other. Both interfered with American shipping, and the British Navy sometimes seized American sailors. President Jefferson ordered a ban on trade with Europe, but the embargo failed to end the hostile acts against the United States. A month after Madison took office, the British minister in Washington, David Erskine, said Britain would stop seizing American ships if the United States would trade again with Britain. But Erskine did not make clear that the British government demanded several conditions. One condition was that the United States continue the ban against trade with France. Another was that Britain be permitted to capture American ships that violated the law. President Madison did not accept these conditions, but he still believed he had reached an agreement with the British minister. He announced that the United States would reopen trade with Britain. Hundreds of ships left American ports. But a few weeks later, Madison received surprising news. The British government had rejected the agreement he reached with Erskine. Letters were exchanged, but Madison could not get a good explanation for what had happened. He finally broke off all communications, and Erskine and his replacement left Washington. America's policy of trade with Britain and France continued to be a serious issue. President Madison approved trade with all countries in 1810. But when relations with Britain did not improve, he stopped trade with the country again in the spring of 1811. Trade was not the only problem, however. A growing number of Americans believed that the British were helping some Native Americans to fight the United States. As the people of the United States began to move to the northern and western territories, the government made treaties with the different Indian tribes. The treaties explained which land belonged to the Indians and which land could be settled by white people. The settlers did not always honor the treaties. Historian Alan Taylor explains that Indian tribes were trying to defend their homelands. He says they asked the British to provide them with guns and ammunition to fight against the American settlements.
And the British were playing a very ambivalent game. In other words, they wanted to keep the Indians on a kind of retainer. In the eventuality that war did happen, they would want to mobilize those Indians. So they did provide them with guns and ammunition, but they hoped that the native peoples would just use them on the defensive.
A leader of the Shawnee Indian tribe, Tecumseh, decided to unite all Indians and help them defend against the settlers. Throughout the West, many Americans believed that the British in Canada were responsible for Tecumseh's efforts. They demanded war with Britain to destroy the power of the tribes. In Washington, a new Congress was meeting. Some of the new members were very different from the men who had controlled Congress before. They were less willing to compromise and more willing to defend America's interests. They soon got the name War Hawks. At the same time, America had a new Secretary of State. Madison chose his close friend, James Monroe. What the United States did not have at that troubled time was a representative in Britain. The British minister in Washington, Francis James Jackson, returned to London when Madison broke off communications. The American minister in London, William Pinckney, sailed home as well. There was no official in either capital to report what was happening. And in the spring of 1812, the United States and Britain were moving closer to war. President Madison had hoped for some sign of compromise, but he was sure there would be war. He had seen the instructions from London to Britain's new minister in Washington, Augustus Foster. The foreign minister warned Foster to say nothing about any compromise. He wanted the United States to see how firmly Britain would stand against neutral trade with its enemies. Also, historian Alan Taylor says the United States did not believe Britain would stop inspecting American ships and taking away any sailors the British thought were British subjects.
And because the British would not change that policy, and the United States was determined to try to force them to change that policy, that's why the war happened.
In the United States, Congress continued to prepare the nation for war. Lawmakers voted to increase the size of the army and to borrow money to pay for things the larger army would need. But not all lawmakers wanted war with Britain. Many Federalists especially opposed it. Congressman Hermanus Bleeker showed the House a list of hundreds of names from his area of New York. He said, "All these people oppose the embargo and the idea of war with Britain. It is impossible," he said, "that we can go to war when the embargo ends 60 days from now. Where are our armies, our navy? Have we the money to fight a war? Why, it would be treason to go to war this soon so poorly prepared. Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin was having a difficult time finding money to borrow. He could get almost no money at all from Federalist bankers in the New England states in the Northeast. Congress had approved borrowing $11 million, but Gallatin found the banks would lend only $6 million to the federal government. The Federalists charged that Gallatin's difficulties showed that the people did not want war, especially the people of New England. If the people of the West and the South wanted to fight, then let them pay for the war. Yet, sure that Britain would not change its hostile policies, President Madison sent a secret message to Congress on June 1st, proposing that war be declared. Madison listed the reasons for war. British warships had violated the American flag at sea. The British Navy had seized and carried off persons protected by the flag. British warships also violated United States waters, interfering with American ships as they entered and left port. Another reason, he said, was Britain's orders against trade with France or allies of France. International law, he said, gave Britain no right to make such orders. Madison also spoke of the hostile Indians of the Northwest Territory and seemed to charge British Canada with helping the Indians. The president's message went to the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives for discussion. The final vote in the House on declaring war was 79-4 and 49 against. In the Senate, the vote was closer, 19-4 and 13 against. President Madison signed the bill into law on June 18th. The War of 1812 had begun. The leaders in Washington did not know it, but 2 days earlier, Britain had ended its orders against neutral American trade. The orders might have been withdrawn earlier, except for a number of events. British Prime Minister Spencer Perceval, under great political pressure, had decided to end the British orders on neutral trade. Businesses and traders were loudly protesting that the orders were destroying England's economy. On May 11th, before Perceval could act, he was shot to death. Not until June 8th was agreement reached on a new prime minister, Lord Liverpool. 8 days later, his government announced that the orders were ended immediately. This was only 2 days before war was to be declared in Washington, and with ships being the only method of communication, the British action was not learned of in time. If the United States had had a minister in London during the spring of 1812, the diplomat would have been able to report progress toward ending the orders. But the American minister, William Pinckney, had returned home a year earlier.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.